last time we talked about the radical reformers that were called Anabaptists, Swiss Brethren. Before that, we talked about the beginning of the Swiss Reformation with Ulrich Zwingli, who was, of course, directly related in many respects to those radical reformers because they came from his followers, his students. Before that, of course, we talked about Martin Luther in Germany. But several times in the process of dealing with those, I have mentioned the German peasant revolt, but I really haven't given you any information about that. And so before we move on to Calvin, which hopefully we'll get to at least an introduction of that tonight, I want to talk to you for a little bit about a man by the name of Thomas Munzer and the peasant revolt. We've seen that in the early 16th century, the Catholic Church had been in crisis for decades. Dissatisfaction with the papal authority had grown, and dissent had spread through the ranks of its subjects. A whole series of pamphlets had been distributed and supported by itinerant priests in the mid-15th century in Germany, formulating the grievances of the people. And at the core of that discontent was the growing secularization of the papacy. During the late Middle Ages, popes tried to gain governmental supremacy in the divided Italy, fighting endless civil wars and participating in political conspiracies. And really the only interest that the Italian popes showed in their German subjects was financial, by trade, which usually took place with faked holy relics and by selling indulgences that we've talked about before. We saw were promised redemption from time spent in purgatory, which of course later really enraged Luther. In May of 1514, Thomas Munzer began serving as a priest in the town of Brunswick, Germany. He was occupied there off and on, really, for the next few years. And it was there that he began to question the practices of the Catholic Church. In letters that were written during this time, he was already being addressed by friends as a castigator of unrighteousness. In the autumn of 1517, he went to Wittenberg and met with Luther. And he became involved in discussions which preceded the posting of Luther's 95 Theses. While he was there, he attended some lectures at the university and was exposed to Luther's ideas as well as others, including Philip Melanchthon and Andreas Karlstadt, who later became a bitter opponent of Luther. Although, as we saw with Zwingli in Switzerland, Luther's criticisms of Karlstadt were largely, at least partially, unfounded. Karlstadt really is another loose end that I'd kind of like to spend some time tying up also, because I feel like Karlstadt got somewhat of a bad rap. He really was not the bumbling idiot, the rabble-rouser that he is sometimes made out to be. For one thing, he had 3 earned doctorate degrees. Luther accused him of supporting and participating in the peasant revolt, but in fact, he was not supportive of it and had always rejected violence as a means of reform. And Karlstadt really had a pronounced influence on the Reformation. He wrote about 90 books, more than any other theologian in Germany except Luther at the time. He was eventually forced to leave Germany, and he went then to Switzerland. He served as a pastor there, and then then as a minister of the university church, as well as a professor of Hebrew and the dean of the University of Basel. And his theology and reforms were accepted by both Zwingli and Calvin, as well as Anabaptist leaders. He really anticipated the Anabaptist arguments against child baptism, which Luther never came to. And so, anyway, that just is another loose end there that I just wanted to mention. Back to Münzer. Münzer had gone to Wittenberg, sitting under some of the lectures of these men, but he didn't remain in Wittenberg for a long time. He left and was reported to be in various locations. And yet he continued to be paid for his position at Brunswick until early 1519. But even before he came in contact with Luther in Wittenberg, Münzer had developed his own reformed ideas, and they often brought him in conflict with ecclesiastical as well as secular authorities, and he often had to flee capture. Of course, Luther's revolt against the papacy and emperor had a deep impact on Münzer, who pretty enthusiastically took up the cause. And in his travel as an itinerant preacher over the next few years, he really helped spread the message of Reformation. Not necessarily the right message, but he did help spread the message of Reformation, coming out as a Lutheran in the cities, at least, of Germany. He preached some pretty inflammatory sermons that found great acceptance among the people because of their anti-papal critique and demands for reform, renewal of the church. And if the message didn't reach the people from the pulpit, it did by pamphlets and books. And thanks to the recent invention of the modern printing press that had come about in Germany, the Gutenberg press, those printed materials became widely distributed and affordable as a means of communication, and also understandable because the texts were being written in the German language, and so enabled the ordinary people to read them and to be involved in theological discussions. Before, and you remember we talked about this with regard to Luther's writings, before everything theological was written in Latin, the common man couldn't read it. So when these things began to be produced in German, it made a big difference. And really the dynamic that the Reformation movement had taken on is in an extremely short period of time was just amazing. But in a couple of years, and again, I mentioned this with regard to Luther's teaching and his writings, within a couple of years, all of Germany was in a theological debate, and the tenets of Luther's reform were just kind of an omnipresent topic in those popular debates. But Münzer thought that Luther's intentions didn't reach far enough. Now, where have we heard that before? Luther's intentions didn't reach far enough. Well, we heard it when we were talking about the Anabaptists, you remember, because the Anabaptists didn't feel like Luther or Zwingli were going far enough or acting fast enough in what they were doing. And so here, and I just say that, I point that out because I want you to see that we have a connection here. You have a connection with of Munzer, with Luther, then you have a connection with the Anabaptist there. And one of the things that you have to do when you're studying the Reformation is that you have to figure out who was a good guy and who was a heretic. Because all over Europe, and we see this as we work through this, so we've gone from, you know, from Italy to Germany and to Switzerland and France and England, and you see these associations between these people, meetings that were held, Zwingli and Calvin and Zwingli and Luther, and then here Luther and Munzer. And all over Europe, there were acquaintances and connections between the players in this historical drama. Some turned out to be solid, godly individuals. Some were pretty solid theologically, but were not all that spiritual. Some turned out to be ungodly, false teachers and leaders. And Munzer was the latter. He came into contact with a lay movement that was inspired by a weaver named Nicholas Storch in the town of Zwickau, Germany. And this movement that he came into contact with there combined radical theological teaching with critique on the social and economic conditions of the day. And he and his followers, Storch and his followers, came to be called the Zwickau Prophets. And Munzer began to incorporate their theology into his own, including the rejection of the Bible as the only source of God's truth. Now, that's interesting for a lot of reasons because that the Catholic Church already taught that. Because the Pope speaking ex cathedra, his voice was equal with Scripture. And so the Bible wasn't the only source of divine truth. Of course, that's what the Reformers were teaching, that only the Word of God, only the Bible was a source of God's truth. Well, he went a little different direction. Munzer believed that, taught that the Bible was not the only source of God's truth in favor of direct revelation from God. And of course, we see that today in some of the so-called Christian movements that are around today. Well, you know, we have the Bible, but we also have prophets and apostles, you know, and so forth. Also, some other things that were a part of Munzer's theology was the impending arrival of the Day of Judgment and the dawn of God's everlasting kingdom on earth. Now, the last two of those doctrines really were expressions of the hopes of the social underclasses in Europe at that time, and particularly in Germany. Most of the craftsmen and the laborers, day laborers, hadn't really enjoyed the economic growth that some of the German cities had seen in the late Middle Ages. And Munzer's contact with the laborers profoundly changed his ideas on the implications of a theological revolution. And you'll see what I mean as we go on. In 1521, Munzer moved to Prague, and there he formulated and published his ideas in what he called the Prague Manifesto. And this manifesto is essentially that of a last days, end time, final judgment type movement. But more than that, Munzer believed in the radical conversion of the whole world into an egalitarian society where mankind is socially equal. What does that sound like?
Socialist.
Socialism, right. Communism, exactly. In 1523, Munzer went back to Germany, arrived in central Germany, where he had been offered a position as a parish priest, and he began then to gain a deeper knowledge of the social problems of the laborers and of the craftsmen that were in his flock as well as in the surrounding countryside. And for a short while, he seemed hesitant to, or at least maybe resisted the temptation to pursue his more radical teachings. But as his flock continued to demand reforms, eventually in 1524, Munzer came out as the spiritual leader of what became this major revolt. By July of 1524, he had broken completely with Luther. Luther, of course, comforted his followers with the teaching of salvation and God's kingdom in the afterlife. Munzer, on the other hand, demanded the creation of a heavenly kingdom here on earth now, and if necessary, with the help of armed forces. Well, some of his followers began taking drastic actions, burning down local churches, and they formed a revolutionary society that was inspired by Munzer's teaching, which by this time Luther had begun to condemn. But over the 20 years since the last revolt that had taken place in Germany, the peasantry had suffered increasing financial demands. Feudal obligations had always been strict, but there was now increased taxation and the duty to serve their feudal lords, and it really had made the life of the peasantry pretty unbearable. And also the rise of the Holy Roman Empire in the late Middle Ages had robbed the peasants of a number of their rights that they had enjoyed under German law. Peasant communities had lost their right to self-administration and access to the formerly common land, as well as a number of personal freedoms. And Munzer put himself at the head of the citizens, putting their demands into action. He chased away the resident monks out of a nearby monastery and began to use that as his headquarters. He established himself and his followers as a community that practiced the sharing of possessions and labor that he had envisioned for the coming utopian society. The poor of the city and the oppressed peasants in the country really became an enthusiastic audience for Munzer. In time, his vision became more and more radical. He began to see himself and his followers now as the chosen instruments of God, who had authorized him to cleanse the earth of all the obstacles to the everlasting divine kingdom. And the only method to achieve that would be an all-out war against the forces of the Antichrist, which, of course, meant the nobility. Well, it appeared that the time for that war had finally arrived, and the tremors of which were felt in late 1524 and early 1525. Peasants in other locations, following Munzer's lead, demanded and managed to attract large followings, including a number of lower aristocrats who became leaders of the revolt. And after some initial success, the uprising met some problems with they came up against organized resistance as the German princes assembled their armies and marched to begin to suppress the revolt. On May the 14th of 1525, the two armies stood in view of one another, both equal in number, approximately 8,000 on each side. But the difference was that the armies of the dukes consisted of well-trained and well-armed professional soldiers and was in pretty much every respect superior to Munzer's peasant army. Well, I was impressed by this as I studied this. And of course, these dukes were by this point increasingly Lutheran. Many of them were believers. And the next day, the dukes offered a three-hour truce in which the peasants were allowed to consider the conditions of surrender that the dukes demanded. And one of those stipulations, of course, was the handing over of Munzer and his leaders, and the rest of them were promised amnesty under the condition that they would immediately disband. Well, Munzer's camp deliberated for a short time because a couple of minor nobles came out in favor of the surrender. They were promptly beheaded, and the battle ensued. Really can't be called a battle. It lasted only minutes as panic broke out in the camp. The peasants fled in disarray, pursued by the troops. And what followed after that was really just an unmitigated slaughter. And when it was over, 5,000 of the 8,000 peasants were killed, and while the prince's troops suffered only 6 casualties. Well, Munzer, having been wounded during the fight, was discovered in a house, arrested, and at that point, really, the peasant rebellion was formally ended. Munzer was subjected to torture and beheaded. And then in the rest of Germany, the peasant rebellion lingered on for a few more months, but in the end suffered the same fate as region by region. The revolt was suppressed. And in all, about 100,000 peasants died in the revolt. Now, I mentioned the impact that this had on Luther. What I mean by that, well, while Luther was not to blame for the revolt, he never got over the part that his teaching played in its inception. And we talked about some of the stress that came upon Luther. Part of it was because of his battles, because of his enemies, because of the attacks, but part of it was because of intense guilt that he experienced through the rest of his life because of those. He really blamed himself for that. All right, that's the Peasants' Revolt, so you understand what that was about. Let's talk about John Calvin for a little bit, and then we'll pick up on that again next week. Of course, John Calvin ended up in Switzerland, but that's not where he was from. Calvin was born on July the 10th in 1509 in France, and he was raised in a staunch Roman Catholic family. The local bishop employed Calvin's father as an administrator in the town's cathedral, and his father in turn wanted John to become a priest. And because of the close ties with the bishop and his noble family, John's playmates and classmates were aristocratic and influential. At age 12, John was employed by the bishop as a clerk. And he also, during those years, won a patronage of an influential family. And through their assistance, Calvin was able to attend college. That's how he was financially able to go to college. And so At the age of 14, he went to Paris, where he learned Latin in preparation for university study. At that time, even though the new theological teachings of the Reformation were spreading around Paris, Calvin remained pretty closely tied to the Roman Church. However, by 1527, Calvin had developed some friendships there with individuals who were reform-minded, and these contacts kind of set the stage, really, for Calvin's eventual conversion and switch to the Reformed faith. He then moved to another college, and one of the things you'll see is that early in his life, Calvin was really a professional student. He moved to another college as a philosophy student, but a short time later, his father transferred him from there to the University of Orléans, which we would pronounce Orleans, to study law, apparently for whatever reason, and there's some debate about why, but for whatever reason, his dad changed his mind, and rather than having him study for the priesthood, he decided he wanted him to study law, so he moved him to a different university where he could do that. Well, he did, and after completing his law training, Calvin entered yet another university, 1529, to study Renaissance humanism. Now, humanism was a European intellectual movement that stressed classical studies, and so it was during this time that Calvin learned Greek. And interestingly, though, he didn't learn classical Greek, or maybe he did, but he also, during this time, learned Koine Greek, which is the language of the New Testament. The New Testament wasn't written in classical Greek. It was written in Koine Greek, which was the language of the common man. And Calvin learned Koine Greek there. Now, at some point during the years between 1529 and 1532, Calvin was converted. And although someone once pointed out to me that Calvin never used the phrase born again, he most certainly was. And in later life, he wrote a couple of accounts of his conversion. One was in his commentary on the book of Psalms. And he wrote, quote, "God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more hardened in such matters than might have been expected from one of my at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein that although I did not altogether leave off other studies, yet I pursued them with less ardor." So at some point, we don't know exactly when it was, but at some point over that three-year period, Calvin came to faith in Christ. Well, by 1532, at the age of 23, Calvin completed his formal education. That just always amazes me when I read about these guys. And of course, they started, you know, young. And the education was intense, it just always tickles me that by 21 or 23, we talked about Melanchthon, who took up a teaching post at Wittenberg when he was 21. By 23, of course, that certainly wasn't the completion of his education, but of his formal university study. Well, at that same time, he also published his first book, had written his first book, which was a commentary on De Clementia, which was an essay by the Roman philosopher Seneca. He wanted to get that published, and the best place to do that, he discovered, was in Paris, and so he went to Paris to publish this book. While he was there, one of his friends, Nicholas Kopp, who was the rector, or what we would call today the president of the university, was going to deliver his inaugural address. And when he did so, November the 1st, 1533, the address was on the need for reform and renewal of the Roman Catholic Church. And in the process of that, he also expounded on salvation by grace through faith, and he concluded with a plea for tolerance for the new evangelical reformers. Well, the address was not well received, and it provoked a strong reaction from the faculty, who denounced it as heretical and forced Kopp to flee. Calvin, who helped him write the message — I didn't mention that, did I? Calvin had helped him write the message. He was implicated as well when the authorities searched his room and they found a copy of the message in Calvin's own handwriting. And so, for the next 3 years, Calvin lived in various places outside of France under various names. And during that time, he studied on his own, he preached, and he began work on the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which was first published in March of 1536. And even though Calvin, and we'll talk more about this later, even though Calvin wrote detailed commentaries during the course of his ministry, during the course of his life, wrote detailed commentaries on almost every book in the Bible, Institutes, which is an exhaustive explanation of Reformed theology, was absolutely his greatest work. Ended up being about 1,400 pages. He revised it many times throughout his life, and so we may spend some time talking about it, maybe even read some sections out of it at some point here. By 1536, Calvin had, by that point, totally disengaged himself from the Roman Catholic Church, and he made plans to permanently leave France and to go to Strasbourg, Germany. However, due to the presence of imperial and French forces, he was forced to make a detour to the south, which took him through the city of Geneva. And Calvin really only intended to stay one night there, but another French reformer by the name of William Farrell, who was living in the city, begged Calvin to stay and to assist him with his work of reforming the church there. And when Calvin didn't want to, he threatened him with God's anger. And so Calvin, really kind of terrified, reluctantly agreed to stay and to use his organizational skills that he had learned as a law student to discipline the fallen city of Geneva. That was the words of Farrell. Well, that began a very long and difficult and yet ultimately fruitful relationship between Calvin and the city of Geneva. He began as a lecturer and a preacher, but by 1538, he was asked to leave because of theological conflicts. Imagine that. That's about right, isn't it, Lou? About 2 years, the honeymoon was over. And so he was asked to leave. He was invited to lead a church of French refugees in Salzburg. And by September of 1538, he had taken up that new position. And he really fully expected that this time it would be permanent. He figured that he would spend the rest of his life, the rest of his ministry there. A few months later, after he got there and began his work there, he applied and was granted citizenship in that city. In August of 1540, he married Idalette de Burr, who was a widow with two children from her first marriage. But the following year, in 1541, Geneva was forced to reconsider its expulsion of Calvin. Church attendance had dwindled, political climate had changed, and the cardinal over the Swiss Catholics wrote a letter to the city council inviting Geneva to return to the Catholic faith. You remember when we talked about Zwingli, much of Switzerland had become Protestant, and so they were invited, I'm sure there was some pressure involved with that too, to return to the Catholic faith. And so the council began searching for an ecclesiastical authority who could respond to this letter. And they asked another fellow who declined, and so it fell to Calvin who they asked. They asked Calvin to return, and his stay in Strasbourg as pastor to the French refugees was so peaceful and happy that he was really emotionally torn. He wanted to stay in Strasbourg, but he felt a responsibility to return to Geneva. Obviously, it turned out to be God's plan, God's will. So he did. He went back to Geneva, where he remained until his death in May of 1564.